Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Veterinary Roundtable, the podcast where we answer your veterinary-related questions while having some fun along the way. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us a review on your podcast provider of choice, and if you have any feedback to offer to improve the Veterinary Roundtable, please let us know. I'm Dr. Emily King.
I'm Devin Fortune.
I'm Courtney Allen.
And we are thrilled to announce that today's episode is particularly special. We're honored to have a special guest on today's episode. This individual has sparked significant discussion with his recent comments and opinions on social media, and despite the attention he's garnered, he has graciously accepted our invitation to join us here today. Without further ado, let's welcome Dr. Evan Levine on the podcast.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
We really do appreciate your time. Yes. And, you know, your willingness to come on and talk or discuss mm-hmm. topics. Mm-hmm. We really feel like when people are willing to have conversations that everyone, you know, contributes to the pool of meaning. And so then therefore you can have better, you know, information disseminated out there, but then you can also make better decisions and things like that. So, you know, I think it's really cool that you came on. So we appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah. Communication is key.
That's right.
It's very helpful.
So to get started, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself? Tell us like who you are, where you, you know, what your job is, you know, that kind of stuff.
I'm a person that grew up in a low income, middle class area in Brooklyn. Paid my way through college and med school. Did my internship and residency in medicine, and then found myself in cardiology. And during working in cardiology for a number of years, I became very unhappy, disenfranchised with what I saw in healthcare. I saw unaffordable healthcare. I saw some physicians taking advantage of patients. I saw big pharma charging three times as much money in the United States as in other countries. I saw doctors over-testing for remuneration. I was one of these six-year med kids, and people said, you know, when I mentioned that, maybe I should sort of spill the beans and write a book on the problems with healthcare. They all told me, you're from Brooklyn, which makes you sort of illiterate as a joke, and B, you're a six-year med kid that, you know, went from high school and finished med school in 6 years, you can't write. And that was my impetus to write my book, What Your Doctor Won't or Can't Tell You. That was a good push for me. It was therapeutic for me. So I wrote a tell-all book on the healthcare system, toured the country, went on lots of big shows, was enlightened by things even on the Today Show, where they tried to more than persuade me not to talk about big pharma and threaten to not put me on the air if I did. I really got enlightened about how industry even controls the news in healthcare. And that's how I've practiced. I'm a bit of an iconoclast, as you can see, a little irreverent at times. I think that medicine should be a holy profession, but like everything else in life, excuse me for saying this, too many things are tainted, as I tell my kids. Whether it's religion, family, medicine, whatever, by the dollar. So I practice the way I preach. I don't overtest. I think my patients appreciate that. The things that I do, whether I write or do these silly TikTok things or whatever, I never accept a dime. Any money I get goes directly to charity because I think it will taint my message. You know, I'm a lover of animals.
Yeah, I saw your videos. You include your cats quite yes. frequently in the videos.
I have loved my animals for years. I was a vegetarian for a number of years. then a pescatarian, not for health reasons, but out of guilt. I hear, believe it or not, more often from my patients, my human patients, not about necessarily also the unaffordability of human healthcare, but also sometimes the unaffordability of healthcare for animals. It's quite severe sometimes. You know, people are crying and unsure what to do. And, you know, I take my pets and I see what occurs. I'm sort of a hands-on person. I have read a number of vet books. I don't practice veterinary medicine, as people suggest I do. One of my cats is acting up in the back. But as I tell people, you know, humans and cats and dogs are, we're mammals, and there's a lot of similarities. I have friends that are vets. I've spoken to people at Cornell at times just about different illnesses.
So when you posted like last week and really stirred the pot, right? You know, you posted and
yep.
Okay. So
I did stir the pot.
So what was the, you know,
what
kind
was
of
the impetus for
yeah,
this?
Yeah. Like what kind of led to that?
So one of our cats, Mochi, which is the only cat we purchased when she was young. My kids wanted a blue Bengal. The two other cats are adopted, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I have a longstanding relationship with a lot of breeders who are broke, and they ask me, you know, for advice, and they have an old cat, and they don't know what to do with it. I'll accept the cat. I actually purchase it because I think they deserve some value. So one cat we took when he was almost 10 years old. That's Nori right here is the one we took when she was three. Nori.
Hello, Normie.
Hi, Nori. Yeah. So this little guy started eating a lot. He looked a little hyperactive. He wasn't putting on much weight. She wasn't drinking a lot. So I felt she didn't have diabetes, and it appeared to me that she had hyperthyroidism. Her heart rate was normal, but she was hyper, and I thought that she might have had early hyperthyroidism. So my wife, my two previous vets both retired. I like to go to the old school vet, both retired. So we got another vet. Decent people and all. But my wife took the cat to the vet, and she was astonished. She showed me, you know, I don't know what to do. The bill is, you know, almost close to $900. So I'm like, wow, holy cow. How are these? No wonder why these people can't afford vet medicine. So I spoke with the vet and I asked him, you know, why is it so expensive? And he mentioned it. And again, I have some friends that live at a distance. And then they told me what occurs is increasing the charges. And the vet even asked me, do you want me to run these labs? And I said, yeah, of course we got to run these labs. I need to know if she's hyperthyroid, which she ended up being, mildly hyperthyroid. And so I started asking friends and people that adopt pets. You know, one of my friends took in eight cats. And everyone agreed, you know, and again, that the cost of care for the animals is really getting, is becoming a barrier to, just like human health care, becoming a barrier to health care. And there were quite a number of people that appeared upset about the cost of health care. And when I found out that there was, and forgive me for saying the word, upcharging for labs, it kind of concerned me. And I try to explain that. And the reason why we don't have that in human medicine. And again, all people are created equal, and everybody in every profession, we always have some who lust more for money than for care. I don't care if it's doctors, vets, car mechanics, let's face it, we're all equal. And some people like to profit. So in human health care, you can't do this because they figured out, the government, that if doctors were able to upcharge for labs, for example, human nature is that they're going to order more tests, right? Because that's the way it is. If we ever did a blinded study about, you know, Dr. A can upcharge and Dr. B can upcharge, the person that can, by human nature, just the way it is gonna do more testing. So we can't do that. So when I spoke to a few vet friends, they said, yeah, people can upcharge. It's heart part of the what we do in vet medicine, akin to the pharmaceuticals, which are, I know, much more difficult now because of things like Chewy and things like that, as well as some prescription diets. And so I was sort of amazed coming from the human industry. And again, people, some of the people said, oh, you're a doctor, you know, healthcare is a ripoff and people can't afford it. And I agree with them. I don't disagree at all. I think our healthcare system stinks. And I'm a big proponent of universal healthcare. And I jokingly say, we're never going to have universal healthcare in this country. And I say, I'll give you an example why. My answer is the metric system. Get it? So we'll never have the metric system. We'll never have human healthcare, universal healthcare. But getting back to the vet medicine, I just felt that the upcharging, especially for lower income people, indigent people, and a lot of those people are the ones that adopt pets or take pets in, strays, it's going to discourage. And when I put that video out, as much as I got the scorn and barbs and whatever from, I also, on the first video, received 10,000 likes with lots of stories, I just put a few down, excuse me. My mom is 84 on Social Security. I'm sorry. And took her dog for an ear infection, and she was guilted into labs that she could not afford $877. You know, and I'm not, again, I'm just saying, these are the things.
I think that the reason that I would say, anyway, that what I saw when I saw the video go out was an intense reaction from the veterinary community, because, you know, and I think that's your first clue, right? That you have a conversation that's worth having, right? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people's first response is either silence or violence, right? I mean, with their words, or they don't use any words at all. I mean, and that's typically what we would call like a crucial conversation. That's the first clue, right? That's a crucial conversation. It's probably a conversation that needs to happen. But I think what, in my opinion, what happened was, because it seemed like when I watched it, that instead of attacking the system, you were attacking the veterinarian. That's kind of why you got this like visceral reaction.
Yeah, I can understand that.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you got this like visceral reaction of like, hey man, you know, we're hardworking, we're compassionate, we're loving. Like, I mean, we are trying as hard as we can to provide care for these patients. And man, we just keep getting knocked down. And, you know, we have a high suicide rate. And there's a lot of things that you may not be aware of, like with our profession.
I didn't know about the suicide rate, believe me. And one of my kids, they were feeling like,
oh man, we're getting kicked while we're down. And so I think that's where you got this like, boom, like mama bear kind of like response, you know?
Yes.
And so I think, you know, that it's perfectly fine to question the way our industry works. I don't think that that's what anybody is saying or anybody is, you know, discouraging you from doing. I think it was just, again, this like, you know, protective mechanism that went into play. And I think that I think there's a way that you can, basically, you know, when you're talking to another group or another, and you know this, I'm sure. I mean, you can show concern. You can also be concerned or, you know, have an issue with something else without offending them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can have that conversation. And that's something that we teach, you know, at the clinic, you know, in terms of how we're going to discuss things, you know. And so I think that's just where that came from. And I do think that there are things, I mean, we're talking about two different systems. So, you know, it's really hard. Yes, we can compare them, but it is extremely hard to compare them because one is a, you know, cash-based system. And then in human medicine, you have all four different ways of paying for things, right? I mean, it could be cash, it could be insurance, it can be Medicare, Medicaid. I mean, so you have like, it's really hard. I think people were having a hard time wrapping their brains.
Yes.
You guys agree?
Well, I do.
Around how, you know, we're using the word scam, or he's using the word scam, he's using the word fraudulent. And I just, you know, we don't feel like we're those kinds of people. Like, and I'm speaking for all of us business owners when I say, like, I don't feel like we're doing something untoward when we are marking up a lab for an invoice. And
depends how much the markup is, I would say.
I would say depending on, I mean, I don't think it's uniform, and I don't think it's uniform based upon the, so it's really dependent based upon the test code as well. So like,
right.
If your test is, if it's a $300 histopathology, fungal, you know, stain, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's going to get marked up less than, you know, potentially a fecal, you know, or something like that. It's from a percentage perspective. But my only thing is I don't understand how, I can't understand how it's similar to the Stark Law when we don't own the lab. You know what I mean? Like, we're not getting a kickback from the lab. It doesn't behoove us to send the labs in. You see what I'm saying?
But it does, because you profit from the lab.
Yes, we do.
That's the difference.
Yes.
So you profit from a lab that you don't perform.
Yes.
And that's where it's not really Stark, but it's illegal in medicine, because you profit from something you don't do.
So that was the most similar thing you could compare
to. If I sent a patient for a chest x-ray, and the chest x-ray came back, whatever, and I said to the patient, okay, so they're charging me $30 and I'm going to charge you $100, that would be unlawful. Because in human medicine, they became very wary of physicians finding a means of, you know, increasing profit, which they did, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, etc. And then, like you said, human medicine got completely dominated by the insurers, completely. After Medicare, the Medicare laws were enacted, and then the insurers came in. And that created a completely different environment. But one thing I see similar, first of all, I must say that I think the vets, a lot of the vets that were really viscerally upset, I'm sure they are struggling. I get it. But there are also some vets that work in relatively affluent areas that I know are not struggling and that are doing more than well and upcharge a lot more than others. And some people that live in those areas in the Northeast, et cetera, they truly cannot afford healthcare. Maybe where you guys are, the healthcare is more reasonable. But where we are, it's not. I mean, you know, that visit, I'm saying, you know, for close to $900 was substantial. Not, you know, luckily I can afford it, but lots of folks. And again, I see a lot of patients. And believe it or not, I advocate that patients, especially when they're lonely, I suggest to their families, adopt a cat for mom. She is lonely. But a lot of folks can't adopt the cat, for example, because they can't afford the health care. The one thing I want to say that I disagreed with significantly is that a lot of the vets said that having a pet is a luxury as an excuse. In other words, if you can't afford the pet, many people said this, then don't have one. And I was sort of astonished. Maybe that was a reflex answer, which they didn't think through.
It is an optional expense.
But I mean, I think we do view it as an optional expense. Now, don't get me wrong. We totally, I would say all three of us, right, totally think there is a ginormous benefit to the human-animal bond.
Oh, 100%.
Right? I mean, like, it helps people with their cortisol levels. It helps people with mental health.
Yes.
I mean,
oh, yes.
Across the board.
Physical health?
I mean you know, across the board.
Lonely people, kids that are lonely.
Absolutely.
We all agree with that, right?
Absolutely. But I also know that, and there are situations, I think, where in those circumstances, care for those patients, for people, for indigent folks that need those, that type of assistance, I think that that is a system that could be set up to provide care for those patients.
Yes.
But for the majority of the population, we do consider it an optional expense. And I don't want to feel bad because we have to run a business and we have to pay our employees to want to work at our practice, and we have to pay to keep our doors open from the standpoint of electricity and rent and all the things that go into
running a business.
Running a business. I mean, but
I get that.
But I mean,
you guys are still in business. You know, no, just to let you know, the doctoring, the that solo practitioners in private practice, except in the big money surgical subspecialties, dermatology, and between you and I think they're significantly overpaid and it's unfair for the family medicine practitioner, the pediatrician, but except for those subspecialties, people are no longer in private practice. But let me just to compare. So ZipRecruiter, the average pediatrician salary, again, this is from ZipRecruiter, maybe they're off a little bit, but it said in ZipRecruiter in the United States, again, this is average, there's highs and lows. The average pediatrician salary is $193,000. In the United States, the average, the average nationwide is $165,000. The average pediatrician salary is $193,000. It's not that much difference, but again, I get it that there are practitioners and vets in solo practice, not practicing in affluent, densely populated areas that are really getting hit hard and in big trouble. And the way to find, they find a way to make it by increasing the cost of things like lab tests.
So when you say that we're upcharging labs, yes, that is not a hidden secret by any means in veterinary medicine, but the upcharge has reasoning behind it. Okay, so there's the business aspect. So we upcharge, we're not trying to like physically make a profit for ourselves, but the upcharge comes from paying your technicians who have technical skills in order to draw blood. I don't know how human medicine works. I've never been in it, but usually you can tell humans, I'm going to put a tourniquet on your arm, sit still. In veterinary medicine, you have to have at least two people in order to obtain any kind of sample on an animal. And if you have to sedate, that can take more than two people. So then you're using the technician's time. And then the other piece that may go into upcharging is the doctors are then interpreting the results. And then you're taking time to talk with the client and go over the results. We don't just upload them to a chart to let you look at. We take a lot of the time, and which I'm not saying human doctors don't, they definitely do. But then you're taking the time to review the labs and come up with a plan and call the owner and spend time with the owner to explain everything. So I think there's a lot of key components that go into what you're saying is upcharging.
Well, because I think that's where the cost got buried.
Yeah. And let's say we don't. Okay, let's not upcharge labs. Let's do what human medicine does. We can't make a profit off labs. But then therefore, we need to upcharge elsewhere in order to compensate for keeping the doors open, keeping the electricity on, keeping your staff paid, things like that. I think it's just like a fine balance.
I get it.
Per se.
I get that. But for the most part, almost always physicians don't charge to discuss lab results. Many get the labs before they see the patient as well. Medicare pays us about $5 or $6 for the draw. That's it. Okay. We don't have any disposal fees or anything like that. So we don't get paid for that. And the lab is a loss for doctors. There's no income there. There's zero. It's just part of the exam. But I'll go into that in a second. But for example, in my situation, they did charge, $24 and change to draw the blood. They did charge $15 for a needle disposal, okay, which I thought was a lot. Some places charge $5. So there's no regulation. You could charge whatever you want. So 15 and 25. So they started out with a $40 charge. And then for like a T4 ED was $215. And according to my friends who are vets, it cost about $85. I thought the upcharge was quite a bit. But let me tell you what happened to doctors. So again, humans are humans, vets, doctors, whatever it may be. Years ago, doctors had their own labs, right? That went away. Then doctors had to send labs out. And they didn't make money. They lost money on it. But what I'm getting back to is that there's no private practice in medicine any longer unless you're in a very affluent area and you practice sort of a concierge fee-for-service medicine, which is a very, very small percent. All the doctors, including myself, found their income substantially reduced, substantially, 30, 40% or more reduced. And then we were all forced, and it sounds like what's going on with vet medicine now, we were all forced to work for either venture capital, an insurer, or a hospital. Okay? That's what happened. We were driven out.
So you see, so what you see happening right now in veterinary medicine is an increase in corporate medicine, right? Is what you're saying is that, okay, like, so I think veterinary medicine does use human medicine. It's kind of like the mother, right? I mean, you look at what they're doing, you know, as an industry, we look at human medicine. We go, okay,
sure.
What are they doing? How are they doing things? Okay. And it's kind of like when, you know, you're with your parents, you're like, I'm not going to do that when I have kids, but I'll do that. Right. I mean, you know, you kind of take away mm-hmm. some of the good things and you yep. try and, but I do, I mean, we are seeing an increase in corporate ownership
yes.
over time. But they are individually owned. Now, whether they all consolidate to like what you're mentioning, which is like, okay, you either have to work for a hospital and there are no, you know, sole individual practice owners anymore. But I mean, what they've done is still is slightly different than what they do in human medicine, which is you still are. So within a corporation, you still are controlling what you're doing on a ground level. Mm-hmm. So like, Right. So we are not subjected to uniform. Well, not all of them. I don't know if some of them do, but subjected to uniform policy across the board. It's yep. all independent hospital driven.
Yep.
So at least there's some individual ownership from the standpoint of, you know, your ability to make adjustments and make decisions on a ground level. Mm-hmm. You know, like if we, you know, there's, we had a situation where we created a foundation just for this purpose of affordable pet care. Like, I think people can do those types of things within their mm-hmm. communities to be able to offer people affordable care when you have a fixable problem. And the whole point of the foundation was for a fixable problem, right? You have a one-year-old dog, a fractured femur, and the owner can't afford to fix it. Well, they've got to euthanize it, right? Amputate the leg, or you can fix the fracture.
Yeah.
So, you know, mm-hmm. having things like that that the community can contribute to, I think are really where the answers lie, so that the people can still maintain ownership of their pet and have help when they need help, but yet the veterinarian isn't necessarily, you know, and when we had those situations, we discounted things so that we were giving something mm-hmm. and then the owner was also getting something, you know, so like the owner was giving something, we were giving something. Yeah. And so mm-hmm. it was like this mutual,
meeting in the middle.
Yeah. Meet in the middle kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, to me, that's where we can really make a difference, you know, on a larger scale for a lot of people. I don't think, and I think you would agree because you're a person who does not, you know, you're kind of against kind of what's happening in human medicine. We certainly don't want the government involved in our industry. I mean, nothing ever runs well when the it seems like it anyway, right? So, I mean, like, we definitely don't want that. I think I could speak for all
yes.
Yep. veterinary communities.
Stay far, far away.
You know, is that that's going to be probably a recipe for disaster. But that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be some form of change.
I was curious because everybody says, okay, I want more affordable healthcare. And you're saying it, you want more affordable healthcare in human and veterinary medicine. So what mm-hmm. is your definition of affordable? Because to me, when I hear the word affordable, that means something completely different to me than it does to Devin, mm-hmm. than it does to Dr. King, than it does to my neighbor. Affordable looks different for every single person, depending on your living situation and your financial income. So,
well, I think affordable doesn't mean access either.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, just because it's affordable doesn't mean there's access.
Yeah. So how would you just define affordable in order for people to not be so upset about all the charges?
I think one of the things and I mentioned that, I think that the vets should be required to publish their fees so folks can shop around easier. It's very difficult for a person to shop around. Let's say there's 10 vets in town, how do you know which one offers, you know, more affordable pricing, for example?
But do you think we hide our prices? We don't hide our prices.
You can call and ask for estimates. Every vet will give you an estimate.
Yeah, but you're in the office. You want to choose a vet. You want to. You don't want to go from vet to vet. You want to be an educated consumer, and you want to choose one of the 10 vets in town. And so, if you had the ability to go online and say, "Okay, this vet charges this, that, and the other thing," this, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They're a little bit further away.
We have clients call in all the time prior to their appointment asking how much their visit might be or what a potential surgery might cost. And then even at the time of visit, we have a standard where we give them a treatment plan before any treatments just so we can get confirmation on each, you know, each test, each vaccine, everything. So they're happy.
But you know, it's hard for somebody if they bring a sick pet in just that minute period of time to make an educated decision without feeling guilty, et cetera. So if they saw ahead of time what the charges would be, or in a particular office, they would, you know, they'd be able to be a little bit more educated about going in.
Do you worry though that all the pricing would become the same? Like,
I don't know.
I mean, like, you're not, you're not supposed to do that. That's some other law, like, where you're not supposed to, like, call around and find out how much everything costs so everybody's thing costs the same.
Yeah, that's collusion. But,
you know,
but
I mean,
let's say there's an office on the east side of town with the more affluent community. It's a beautiful office. You walk in there, it's like a museum. And on the west side of the town, there's a vet that gets the same job done, just as good, not as pretty. And the fees are less. Say, you know, whether it's food, veterinary medicine, whatever. In healthcare, in human medicine, the difference is the prices are all the same because they're all dictated by the insurers. Okay? So you know when you come to me, you got a $50 copay. Okay? And if you're a Medicare, you know what it's going to cost you if you don't have the gap insurance, the 20%, because Medicare dictates how much you can charge.
But don't you think that nobody knows what anything costs in human medicine?
Mm-hmm. True. Nope. True story.
Like, we don't know what anything costs. Like, you could go and get an MRI. Well, and I think, okay, you know, and again, humans are different than dogs and cats and small animals.
But
in
those
general
prices are dictated if most people are insured. So for example, somebody went, One of the very popular TikTokers, it wasn't too happy with me, was mentioning her friend's bill. Oh, look at this. $1,400 for a lab at the hospital. Those numbers are meaningless. Nobody pays those charges. They just make up these numbers. They're not getting reimbursed $1,400 for a lab. They get reimbursed whatever the insurer is going to reimburse. It's a small, small, small percentage of that.
But no, but like it is that much though. Like, you know, like if I use the example of my youngest son's ear, nose and throat doctor, for example, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot of money. Now, when I owned the clinic and I had Christian Healthcare Ministries as my form of insurance, because I don't have like private insurance or what insurance, mm-hmm. insurance. I mm-hmm. mean, you know, you're basically paying cash for everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you do have to call around and find those prices. I do have to find out, okay, you know, can I get this medicine over here cheaper than getting this medicine over here cheap? You know, mm-hmm. I can't go.
Yeah,
there isn't
you
like
had
a
very unusual insurance. I know,
you know,
about
there's,
that.
There's, and not everybody, I mean, you know, there's, I think a, when you're talking about sole practitioners or people that own small businesses, they are stuck in some scenarios with those types. And it was very good to us. It was not an issue, but it did require legwork. It was very similar. I would consider it very similar to owning a pet and having to figure out, to your point,
what you had. Absolutely.
What can I afford? Where do I want to go? Do I care about the quality of care? You know, that those kinds of things.
Imagine, I just want to bring this out. Imagine that a pet insurance was created akin to a United Healthcare policy. Okay. So basically you pay a premium, right? I don't know if you guys would like this, but you pay a premium and you go to a vet office instead of a doctor's office. And the rates have been negotiated to any of those physicians who want to participate in that healthcare plan. That's what real insurance is. And when you go to, let's say, a vet for well care, you have a $50 copay charge once a year, okay? Or if you go for other reasons, there's a copay. And the remainder is paid by the insurer, not by the patient, or the way it is now with the pet insurance, you know, you pay and you get money back.
Well, I mean, I think there's a Trupanion will pay the hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, so we do have Trupanion who will actually pay the hospital instead of pay the owner. But it's, and I think they've kind of have looked at human health insurance and have said, okay, what things do people not like about human health insurance? Mm-hmm. What things do they like? Mm-hmm. And they've kind of tried to marry the two. None of the systems are perfect, but we have like Nationwide, we have Trupanion, we have mm-hmm. several
yeah.
that are out there. And I do think that they do a decent job of, but you know, you do in some of the instances, you do pay the bill first before mm-hmm. the insurance pays.
Yeah.
I just did surgery on my son's golden retriever for, we had to have his anal glands removed and it was $1,800 and he has insurance on the dog because the dog has problems with its anal glands. He has insurance on the dog. The insurance does cover it, but he had to lay out the money first.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
yeah, that's the way.
And then
of all, that surgery in the New York metro area, where are you guys actually?
We're in Indiana.
Okay. I think my wife's in Indiana right now. My kid's shopping, or she's just trying to figure out what college to go to.
Okay.
I think they're on the way to Indiana as we speak. But anyway, good antiquing there. So getting back to what we said, you're in Indiana. You should see the fees in, you know, New York City, okay, the suburbs of New York City. Your fees could be a third of what they charge here.
But doesn't it all go together?
Why there can't be a blanket uniform everything in vet med, but the cost of living is different everywhere.
Right. Like, I don't.
So you can't make everything the same.
But in human medicine, they take that into account, but the disparity, the difference is small. It's maybe 5 or 10%. It's not double or triple. Okay. You know, there's not only wealthy people living in the New York areas, there are people, you know, everyday middle class folks that they can't afford this.
So also with the $50 copay, you're saying, OK, all you have to pay is a $50 copay. But how much money are you paying over a certain amount of years or every month to have that insurance policy?
Mm-hmm.
It's because then the owners are going to be paying $50 when they come in. Yeah. But then you're going to double what they're already paying by keeping that insurance policy open and keeping it able for them to use it. So then the owners are still ending up paying more at the end of the day, right?
But the cost of healthcare is diminished because you have a huge corporate insurer. The same is what happens with human healthcare, negotiating the prices for you, okay? So for example, let's say an echocardiogram, right? Without, you know, an insurance is negotiating a price, maybe an echocardiogram is $300. Before the insurers were around, an echocardiogram might have cost $600, but they've negotiated that price. And then doctors eventually needed to accept insurance because everyone began accepting the insurance, and that drove the cost of healthcare temporarily. Reduce the cost of healthcare. I just want to remind you that the majority of cost of healthcare is not from physicians, but from, you know, the hospitalizations and all the rest of the stuff. Again, I don't believe human healthcare is affordable, but just to remind you that, you know, one step into an emergency room in human medicine and a hospital, and you know, you could be talking six figures.
Yeah, right. I don't disagree with you.
Right.
Yeah.
So your primary concern is just that the cost of veterinary medicine is going up enough that you are concerned that people will not be able to afford health care for their pets.
Yes. They're going to be priced out.
Mm-hmm. Be priced out of it.
And if you read a lot of the messages that I received, a lot of people are no longer they wrote to me, you know, so-and-so passed away. It cost me $3,000. I can't afford another pet, et cetera, and I'm no longer going to adopt, things of that nature.
I just don't know how you tell an industry, like, well, now you've made enough, or...
I don't know.
You know what I'm saying? How do you...
I gotcha. I don't know.
Who's the great arbiter of that? Like, who's going to say, well, now you've made enough profit, or you've, because what I can tell you is that the money that is being made, the profit margin is not ginormous in veterinary medicine. So for example, you're looking at, and maybe this seems big, I don't know what it is in human medicine. I mean, I know some other industries, but you know, you're probably looking at somewhere between 8% and 12%, you know, depending on where you're at, how well you're running your clinic. You could get upwards to the high teens if you're very efficient and you're very skilled at controlling your cogs and your labor. But the majority of places, it's probably around 10%. So the thing that I'm concerned about is, you know, we really invest a lot of resources back into the clinic. And I know that our cost is coming from better education, better tools, better technologies than we used to have a long time ago, right? I mean, cost of veterinary care was much less 10 years ago, but oh my gosh, we can do so much more than what we could do before. So pets are living longer. They are living better lives. There are more things available to be able to take care of them. I don't disagree that there's a difference for some people in what they can afford and what other people can't afford. But I also don't know how you tell somebody you've made enough, you're done. You know what I mean? Like, I don't agree with that because I'm a capitalist.
I get that your margins are not that great in your areas. But again, I think that in other areas, there are some vets, you know, who are quite affluent. But what happened in medicine when the profit margins diminished, and may happen in vet medicine, is that doctors teamed up. They formed groups. They were able to, you know, hire a surgeon, hire a radiologist, hire a lab. And that's the way they survived for years. The solo practitioner, as I mentioned, is essentially gone. And I think that maybe it's just the way you're suggesting, is that the solo practitioner, the economics is not very good, and eventually vets are going to have to make a decision, much like doctors did, to either form large groups, create a concierge practice in affluent areas, or go work for, you know, corporate America, or the Vetcos, or whoever Mars is buying up, et cetera, et cetera. That's just my opinion, based upon, and people, you know, people say, I don't know what I'm talking about, the vet people, but based upon what happened in medicine, this already happened.
You're just drawing correlations. I totally get it. Yeah. I mean, and I think the thing that we're all scared of is, like, you look at, see what's happening. You know what's happening in the UK right now with veterinary medicine, like where they've basically capped what veterinarians can make, like you can only make a certain amount, and they're doing all this investigating basically into pricing. And the government's kind of come in, and I don't know all the details, so I don't want to talk as if I know what's happening exactly, but that's the general gist of it. And I think all of us over here are like, holy crap, like these guys are making, you need the autonomy to be able to deliver, the service that you desire to be able to deliver to these patients, you know, and not everybody can afford the gold standard, you know, procedures and processes and diagnostics and tools that we have, but we also are very good at meeting people where they are. Absolutely. I really genuinely feel like we have, hey, you know, we're always going to offer the best standard of care. And so if people can't do that, we completely understand. I don't make anybody feel bad because they can't. I say, okay, well, you know, if we can't do that, then let's do this, you know, or let's do this. Here are some other options that we can do.
You can do the bare minimum and still keep your pet healthy.
Yeah.
As long as they don't have like a severe underlying condition, but That's why when, like, for example, we have low cost clinics. Like, so if you aren't able to afford the, I mean, it's also quality of care, like Dr. King said earlier. Mm-hmm. But there are options for people who cannot truly afford the higher class mm-hmm. clinics or whatnot. Yeah. So there, we, I mean, we have options.
We have clients who go to low cost.
Yeah. What do you
we
think?
We have clients who go to low cost for just vaccines and heartworm tests and then kind of use us, for our gold standard of medicine, to prioritize the bigger.
Well, we don't have that in the Northeast around here. I mean, the only thing we have sort of is maybe a Vetco clinic for a vaccine, which, you know, just looking it up, for example, I paid $67 for a rabies vaccine for my cat. The Vetco is $32. If you have five strays you took in, right, we're talking a significant amount of money. But again, look at the disparity in charges. Now, when we talk about the upcharging, I mean, there's got to be too much. What is too much, in your opinion? Let's take a T4ED, okay? Equal immune dialysis T4. What do you guys, I just want to know, what do you guys charge for a T4ED?
Oh God, I don't know. Here's a rule.
$156. Okay.
The veterinarians don't know much about the cost because I don't want them influenced by the cost. So at our practice,
but you charge $156, and here we get charged $215. Okay, and then you take two or three more labs, and there's a huge difference. See, this in medicine, the difference I mentioned is like 5-10% at most. But in vet, it's all over the place because you guys really make a decision what you're going to charge. And that's why I don't think it drives.
I really want to make across the point that it really doesn't. I know it might be hard to appreciate this, but I really don't think that it drives more tests. More test requests from the veterinarian because we are a cash, you know, system. You're going to end up getting bit in the ass. If you are over-diagnosing, people aren't going to come see you. We do all these audit reports, you know, and then you do monthly reports. You know, if somebody is overcharging or over submitting labs,
binged right away.
Boom, you know right away. And that's not the culture.
Who knows?
Oh, the managers.
Yeah, I have never met a veterinarian. I mean, I might be biased because I'm in this industry, but I have never met a vet who is in it for the money ever.
Nope.
Listen, any veterinary professional.
I'm older than you guys, and believe me, I went into healthcare for one reason. I thought it was a cool thing. You help people; it's great. But trust me, okay.
I'm not saying there aren't
humans.
Bad.
Are humans, okay? I don't care. You're very decent, kind, caring individuals. But out there, there are some vets, just like doctors, car mechanics. I don't care what it is, where there are people profiting. There's no question. It's human nature.
Profiting, but you mean over-profiting.
Over-profiting, absolutely.
Right.
There's bad people everywhere.
Right.
But that doesn't give you the right to. No veterinarian is going to go through 8 to 12 years of schooling just because they want money. It's because they care about animals.
Doctors, they did that.
Yeah,
people are people.
Yeah, because they care about people, not just because they want to make the money.
But what he's saying is
somewhere along the line,
you're right.
There's change.
Right.
Okay.
He's saying that.
I see it. I know it. I've witnessed it. Okay. I don't know. I always wanted to know, where does that medical student change? You know, from wide-eyed, loving science, where did that student change to become a profiteer? I don't know. Maybe they had financial problems, spousal problems. Who knows? But it happens. In healthcare, again, there's a bit of regulations, far from perfect. Doctors cheat all the time. You can look at some of the DOJ articles that they have, you know, doctor fine $4 million, blah blah blah, happens all the time. But humans are humans. I'm sure it's happening in vet medicine too.
I'm not going to sit here and say that somebody isn't trying to be as profitable as possible. I think that they are absolutely trying to be as profitable as possible because we also have loans that we pay back, meaning like a loan to own the business, to build the building. Like you have financial stakes that you have, you know, banks that are backing your risk.
Besides that,
you know what I mean? So
there's always some bad folks, always, everywhere. Religion, politics, I don't care where you're at. There's always some bad folks looking to profit.
I agree.
That's the way human nature is.
I like to believe that there's more good humans in our industry.
I think that's the difference. Is that when you post it,
you think vets are special?
No.
And more so
in our, like in veterinary medicine and human medicine, I like to believe that there's more good people in the professions than bad.
Yeah. And I think
more better vets than, okay.
Well, and doctors, human doctors.
Yeah. Like I think what you're saying is you believe that in the goodness of people, that there's more absolutely. Good people than there are bad people.
Yes.
Is what you're saying.
I certainly hope so.
Yes. And I think that
there are, but you know what? All you need, like in human medicine, if you have 5% of the bad docs are bad, 95% are decent docs with 5% of profiteers, that 5% can end up costing the healthcare system 25% or something like that. What I'm just saying is that in human medicine, there is a degree of regulation that the insurers basically tell you and force you, you can't charge above a certain amount. That's it. That's what it is. Same thing for the labs. There's no profit on the labs. Look, if I also heard from some people, okay, if you don't upcharge on the lab, then you're going to find other means, maybe bring people back, increase the cost that way. Because people have to survive. I get that. But two things about the upcharging is, I'm going to tell you, some very smart people that I spoke to, no one knew about upcharging vet medicine. You guys know about it. Outside vet medicine, people didn't know about that. I think that should be out there and published to the person to know.
So would you like us to tell clients when they come in for labs that, hey, we're going to upcharge you for this test. It's this much at the lab. How would you like us to go about that, making that a general known thing to the public?
I think the people should know.
How would you like us to do that?
You could put it on your, on a form that people come and look.
Just use the word that we upcharge?
Not upcharge. Use whatever word you like. Lab, CBC, our cost, $100. Your cost, $200.
And what would that accomplish?
Well, I think people need to know about that.
But I don't understand the benefit of telling. I just don't understand what that would accomplish. That's confusing to me.
Yeah, well, I just think people need to be educated in general about the upcharging.
And then, yeah, if they ask us, we'll be upfront with them. But I don't, but like, do you know, think it doesn't make difficult. Sense?
So you think that
it's
people really...
It's kind of difficult to ask.
So people, do you think that truly people think that veterinarians do not operate a business? Do they think it's really non-profit? Like, I think they already know.
No, they don't. But I think...
Like,
they
I feel like
know.
It's just no, an assumption. You can assume profit. That we're going to...
Look, we live in a capitalist society. I get it. That's fine. That's the way it should be. I'm with you there. But I do think that lots of people feel, and again, there was thousands of likes, that a lot of people feel, going back, that the cost of care, especially in certain areas of the United States, has become unaffordable.
That's called inflation as well. Yeah, I mean, the cost of living is ridiculous. Up everywhere.
Well, you're charging $158 and somebody's charging $220 for the same test.
But could you...
That doesn't happen when you go to Quest Labs.
But what if for us, our lab, Antech, is charging us $75 and we charge $150? But in New York, Antech is charging them $100 mm-hmm. and they are getting charged then $200.
There could be different contracts.
Right? There's
with the labs.
Definitely
there
that
be...
going on.
Yeah.
So the labs are charging clinics differently.
Yes.
Depending on the volume that you send to the lab,
yep.
as well as agreements they have with mm-hmm. clinics. So like what might cost me to run a T4ED, a TSH, a, you know, mm-hmm. total T4, whatever it costs me, it's not the same that it costs the guy down
you
the road.
They're charging you less?
Oh, it depends. It very much depends on, absolutely. It depends on what agreement. Did I say that I will use your lab for 7 years?
Yeah.
Okay, I did.
Contract.
All right. Now I will charge you 10% less on all your lab fees.
But that's a contract that you made. It has nothing to do with the geography of the doctor.
But it could be if you had a clinic 5 miles from me, they won't give you a contract because you don't have enough volume. So mm-hmm. now your lab fees are all going to be higher than mine down the road. You're going to be less profitable. You may
goes back to why I believe that in order to survive, that vet group should join up together. Almost like the mom and pop.
I think that's their form in the corporations. I think that's what you're seeing, right? I mean, you yeah. have a corporation that owns 300 clinics. They now have a voice, correct. Right? So now correct. They're able to say, okay, Antec.
Just like the Value Hardwares, for example, all the hardware stores went out of business, right? Because of the Home Depots, et cetera. The ones that survived joined a purchasing group and they call themselves, for example, Value Hardware. Or in medicine, doctors joined up and created groups, again, to reduce cost, to reduce the bookkeeping, the accounting, et cetera, et cetera. And they survived. But my question to you, do you think for most people that vet care is affordable?
I think that the veterinary care that you want to get for your pet is affordable. If you're talking about you want to be able to do gold standard care, everyone be able to do whatever they can to save a pet, then no. Because not everybody's in the same boat, mm-hmm. but everybody can get a physical exam on their pet. Everybody can get vaccines on their pet in order to protect them through the course of the year. I am not going to sit here and say that everybody should be able to afford a 16-year-old dog with Cushing's disease that also has hypothyroidism and,
right.
oh, by the way, now became diabetic. Mm-hmm. No, they probably should consider euthanasia.
But your pet goes to the local pet ER, right?
Yeah.
And the local pet ER says, okay, that's $3,000. And you don't know what the pet has. The pet's not old. And that's what it costs there for like a day. And so that's euthanasia for a lot, even though it's potentially curable.
I think that the emergency care, though, it's a whole different animal. Like mm-hmm. from the standpoint of the cost of running an ER facility is ridiculous because labor costs are through the roof because we have shortages of veterinarians. So you're doing anything you can to get a veterinarian to work in an ER facility.
Mm-hmm.
You
pay
have to pay them a particular amount and techs to work overnight.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous the cost that those clinics incur in order to stay open. So I have no doubt, depending on what happened with a patient, that they could easily have a $3,000 bill at an ER
right.
clinic.
Mm-hmm.
No,
that's
doubt.
Easy.
Now, what I will tell you is that you're starting to see general practitioners pursue additional areas of expertise in order to be able to offer care at a more reasonable price.
Yes.
So, for example, there's a procedure called a TPLO. It used to be that only board-certified orthopedic surgeons could perform that procedure. That procedure now is like $8,000 a leg. Okay. That's cash for people. Mm-hmm. That's a freaking car, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it is. And I get why they have to charge what they are. I'm not mad at the ER clinics or the specialty practices for charging it. That's not my gripe. You got to do what you got to do to stay in business. I am not going to belittle you for doing it. So what do? We go learn how to do a TPLO. So that we can charge half of that or whatever we deem reasonable for our services mm-hmm. and our expertise level. So, I mean, I do think you're going to see general practitioners pursuing other, you know, avenues mm-hmm. to be able to offer care because we see the need. We go, oh my gosh, we want people to be able to have that procedure,
mm-hmm.
you know, but you can't offer it for a pittance either. Like you got to go get hours and hours of training. The equipment is, you know, tens of thousands, not $100,000 to get the equipment on board. I mean, like, so there is an inherent cost mm-hmm. to be able to offer the service. But I do think you will see that. I think you'll start to see more and more of that because I don't see the prices coming down. I mean, I really don't, especially not in the ER facilities and the...
No. I mean, it's outpacing inflation, actually, according... And in fact, it's even outpacing some forms of human healthcare at this point. What do you think? What do you think, going back to what you mentioned in England? What do you think? What was the backlash there that created such a dramatic change?
Because vets are very unhappy that they're getting capped.
Right? I think originally.
Why did they get capped?
Why did they get capped? Because it was the pet owners that were complaining about pricing.
There you go.
And so then they did an investigation. They have a department. It's called CMA. It's something. I can't think of the name of it. Harrison, can you look that up and tell me the name? And they basically, they went and did a whole research basically on pricing throughout the country.
I can get back to you. In fact, I've done some consulting on international care, and I'm fairly close with an MP in England, a member of the parliament. He'd get back to me. I find that really interesting.
Yeah. And so,
I'm going to tell you, we've spoken about human health care in England, and many people are not very happy with the quality of care they have there either, which is, you know, a universal style health care. But that's pretty amazing that they went so far to cap.
They capped salary. Well, I think they capped salaries for veterinarians. So veterinarians in England are making somewhere between, I think, in human dollars, in US dollars, like 36 to 70,000. But the problem is, Dr. Levine, the cost of education is the ROI.
Crazy. I agree. One of my daughters might want to be a vet.
You can't, I mean, you know, you're going
I
out
gotcha.
30 years to pay back a loan. You're going to end up paying back three times.
Look, if they cap fees, they should reduce the tuition. I got it. Look, I could have gone to med school for free. Some of my friends volunteered to, you know, one year in the military service, one free year for med school. I worked and tutored, etc. But I get it. You know, the cost of education is crazy. The other thing I just wanted to bring up, one of the ways to reduce healthcare costs in human care has been to provide have other sort of healthcare providers, nurse practitioners, physician assistants. I don't think there's anything in the vet system, is there?
That was actually brought up
By the AVMA.
Were talking about having a nurse practitioner in veterinary medicine. Mm-hmm. But it almost didn't make sense necessarily.
Well, it's basically RVTs. Were describing it is...
Yeah, it's already kind of a thing.
Right.
But then we just get one extra thing.
Right. That's exactly. You have a vet tech, and the vet tech then goes back to school for... That's what happens for nurse practitioners. You have a registered nurse, and then the registered nurse goes back to school nurse practitioner school and does some rotations, and then has a degree of nurse practitioner where they can prescribe, work under a physician, and then eventually even work on their own. But order to reduce cost or improve profit, a lot of these very, you know, large groups, medical centers, etc., we all have nurse practitioners and PAs.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, I think that the impetus behind the AVMA doing that is caseload. They're overwhelmed. Veterinarians are overwhelmed with the casework. So then it was a role that they were discussing bringing on board. It is a registered veterinary technician role. And then you would be doing additional, like, basically different services, you mm-hmm. know, kind of a thing.
So then we'd be going back to school and putting ourselves in more debt, and we already don't make enough.
I don't think that they were I don't think that they were talking about them going back to school.
Giving us more.
Now, they didn't go down the road of like, what does this look like? That's they were true. Basically
it's
just.
It's very profitable now. Like, should the nurses put the energy may go into back it? To school and have more debt. But in the end, it's far more profitable than the debt they incur.
Well, and okay. I think the AVMA
did substantially better.
The AVMA was speaking as to how do technicians, because pay for technicians is an issue. Mm-hmm. So how do we increase pay for technicians? And so we can increase their role, basically.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
You know, so they were talking about basically this additional role. It's still a registered veterinary technician. I think that then we can see that people getting paid adequately mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. the services that they're able to perform.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I think is a way they were trying to tackle that problem and then offload some work that veterinarians don't necessarily need to be doing, you know, and delegating some of that then to that role is what they were talking about. So, no, I mean, I think that, you know, they're looking at things like that. I think that it just takes time. You know what I mean? For them to it's the AVMA it's like I'm sure the human form of the AVMA.
What's going to happen if people can't afford vet care? Those folks that adopt from the kennels, and then the kennels start saying, look, we have to sacrifice more and more pets because less folks are adopting.
I think the people who can afford vet care outweigh the people who can't. And like we said earlier, it's not heartless. I'm not trying to sound heartless or anything like that. But if you truly cannot afford a pet, then you should not have a pet.
As it becomes less affordable, less folks may not adopt pets. It's going to happen. It's economics.
So you're worried that they're going to relinquish pets, or you're worried that
they're not going to adopt? The shelters are going to become full.
Shelters are already full. Yeah.
There you go. They're going to be.
But
well,
it's not because people can't afford it. I don't think.
I got a lot of answers that people said they're not adopting anymore.
I think that, they probably aren't because they don't want the financial responsibility.
Exactly.
But don't you think that's a wise decision, though? They're doing the right thing. They didn't adopt it because they couldn't afford it.
I don't know what the answer is here, but in the end, the problem is that the shelters are full now. Less people are adopting. Where does this end?
I don't know if it's the responsibility of the veterinarians.
I'm not saying it's anyone's responsibility. I'm just saying what happens.
I don't have the answer for that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the veterinarians are going to be able to figure out the answer for that because their primary objective is patient care. So, like, I mean, they're...
Do you think that it should be any regulation of vet care? And what regulation do you think is appropriate?
Should there be any regulation? My instinct is no, because I think that the companies, the business entities need to be able to control what they're doing in order to remain a going concern. And mm-hmm. what works for one place is not going to be the same that works for another place. So that's a primary concern, is that if it's regulated, then you have no autonomy to be able to make decisions for yourself. I have no idea if that's true or not. That's just my first instinct.
I agree.
Now, I do think...
I know you guys agree, but that's on your side. If you ask the patients or the owners, like in England, they would disagree. There's, you know, this. It's a complex question. It's difficult to answer. I mean, too much regulation is not good. Not enough regulation is not good. They can talk about this in Congress every day. But there's a lot of people that think that there needs to be regulation. But, you know, again, no offense to you. You guys sound like great people. And believe me, if I had to go back to school, maybe I'd be a vet. I love animals very dearly. But I remain concerned from a consumer's point of view. I'm not a vet. I get what you're saying, okay? And I'd be fighting tooth and nail, too. I remain concerned that the cost of caring for an animal is becoming unobtainable for a lot of people.
I just don't think the veterinarians can absorb the...
It's a problem. They can't absorb it. I gotcha. What if big business took over all of vet medicine? I'm just saying, I wouldn't want that. Do you think that would help the cost of care? It would drive it up.
If who took over?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. If who took over?
If a large corporate took over basically the, you know, the majority of care in vet medicine. You went to everyone decided to go to a Vetco equivalent, and they drove out all the private practitioners.
I don't think that would be good.
I don't think it would work. I don't think it would work.
No.
I think that I think that competition is what drives all of it, right? I mean, you know, if you are charging a lot and now you aren't making money because you're charging too much, and so then therefore you no longer have enough clients. And so then you're going to do something. You're going to drop your prices. You're going to do something to increase value. You're going to do something to make things change. I think that you're still, though, ultimately still in control of your own destiny. I think that that's why I think that it self-corrects itself. Like, I don't think you...
I know. You're a free market person. I got it. Yeah, I got
it. You're right. Yeah. I mean... But I don't want some huge corporation coming in and then dictating mm-hmm. the practice of medicine.
But they might.
Yeah. I mean, but
right?
Holy cow, you know, some of the things that are cool.
I'll tell you how they might. Vetco comes into all the neighborhoods and they're doing this a bit now, and they undercut your prices substantially, right? And then you guys close up or you start working for Vetco, and as the competition goes away, the price incentives diminish, right? And then the prices are more again. But in that small period of time, Vetco sucks it up and halves the prices of what you guys are asking for. Could happen.
It could happen. I mean, not...
They're doing that now, for example, for the vaccines and simple exams.
Yeah, but I think you have enough people that value the relationship with the veterinarian that they don't care that it costs less. So they come in. So like, you know, the rule of thumb is you have 20% of your clients pay 80% of your bills. So, I mean, that is.
I've been around, I people say that, but when it comes to the pocketbook, I think they go reluctantly, but they go to the less cost. Just my opinion.
Maybe it's possible, but I just wouldn't. And we may see that, right? I mean, you have Banfields going in everywhere. You have
Pet
Walmart's going to have. Isn't Walmart going to have somebody?
I don't know. Probably
it's somebody like that.
Whole Pet Wellness Clinic. Those
I mean, like
everywhere.
You have, like you're going to have that external pressure, but it just makes us on the outside perform better. It's going to drive us to be better, to have more value associated with our services. You know, and those systems, what ends up happening, to be honest with you, is in those current systems, employees aren't happy.
Yep.
And if employees aren't happy, then clients aren't happy, because clients can tell when they walk in the door, is this a good place to transact or is it not?
Employees like vets or vet techs or everyone, you think?
Just everyone.
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 Yeah.
Because if you look at the market, which I did, you know, they're offering, you know, bonuses and...
Exactly. They can't get anybody. You know, they're throwing out these crazy sign-on bonuses and these crazy, you know,
crazy
because... can't find people. And even if they do, then people walk, you know. And
so where are the graduates going then?
They're going to good practices. They're going to practices that value culture, that value... quality of life, that value, you know, mentorship, that value good medicine. I mean, I would say that's where the people are going.
Yeah.
If you are a good practice, you will attract talent. Good people find good places to work.
Yep.
And, you know, that's something that we constantly, you know, talk about, or I talk about, because I'm very passionate about that, you know, you can control your culture. You can make a difference for people. People can, you know, feel good when they come to work. So much of veterinary medicine is inundated with crappy places to work and frustration and anxiety and depression. And it doesn't need to be that way. But those places that are good will remain an ongoing entity. I have no doubt in my mind.
Yes.
If they continue to do those things. And corporations just aren't going to help that.
Nope.
They're just not going to be able to do that. They have a different purpose in mind. At least the corporations in our industry right now, that that's just not where they're at. Their heads aren't there.
Listen, human healthcare, as I mentioned, whatever you might call it, if it's, whether it's nonprofit or profit, it's all corporate.
Mm-hmm.
It's all corporate now. Okay. That's it. Done.
Now it's interesting, you know,
Done. Everyone's working. I jokingly say that the few people that are in private practice still, as I mentioned, they're either a concierge, affluent area, or believe it or not, some of these practices are in the low-income areas because they're doing things they should not do. The Medicaid government plans don't vet the tests, okay? They don't need approval, so they just overtest like crazy. It's despicable. But those are the ones that survive. When I was leaving, I was in private practice for a while with a bunch of buddies. Just to let you know what happened to us. You had the alternative, and some docs did it, of starting to do more testing, okay? Because as the squeeze happens, right? Who's paying the car bill? Who's paying this? More testing. Find another test. Find something to do. And I never crossed the line, ever. And so my wife came to me and said, geez, we're having trouble paying the bills here. And then we sold to a hospital. And in some respects, it's actually better because I don't have the headaches of dealing with, you know, I was the president. I don't have the headaches of dealing with the mess like you guys do, of running a practice, which was very stressful. But we lost all our autonomy. And that's the way it is. That's the way medicine is in the United States right now. Okay? We all work for someone except concierge, the surgical subspecialties are making a fortune, like the orthopedic surgeons, an absolute fortune, and the dermatology and things like that, fee for service, and then some of the bad guys, and that's it. That's it. Everybody else is employed.
Well, I think that, you know, our industry is definitely always looking for solutions. We're always trying to make things better. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody would sit here and say we have it exactly perfect, but I do think we have it better than human medicine right now. So, I mean, you know, I appreciate everything that you're saying. I appreciate the discussion. I think, do you guys have any other questions that you wanted to ask Dr. Levine?
I don't think so, but I don't think they can be similar.
They're just so different.
Too different to enforce what you're saying. I don't think it's feasible. Personally, that's my opinion. Just don't think it's possible.
Yeah. But I really do appreciate like I said, without the discussion, you know, we don't make ourselves better, you know?
Agree 100%, you know, in the importance of dialogue.
And for the record, I just want to say, you know, we don't condone any. You're allowed to do whatever you want and do whatever you think, say whatever you want,
can have your own opinion
on your channels, mm-hmm. and do whatever. No one should harass you. No one should be, you know.
Oh my goodness.
You know, so we don't condone any of that behavior.
I know you don't. I saw that from the start.
You know, so
that's why I came on.
We respect your opinion very much,
and no one should be calling your clinic. No one should be calling your clinic and doing and bothering you and things like that. I
said to myself, holy cow, why did I do this? Oh my goodness.
Well, like I said in the beginning, that's your first indication that it's a crucial conversation right there.
But you know what happened? I'll tell you what happened. In the beginning, I got the most beautiful letters. Thank you for sticking up for us. Thousands. And then it got out to the vet community. And I would say, strangely enough, it was mostly the vet techs that were upset. Which I don't understand, because I said, hey, I wish you know, you're not the vet. You know, you're working there, but whatever.
Well, I think it's a very tight-knit community from the standpoint of we're all in it together, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it takes, you know, an entire team to care for these patients, because mm-hmm. you can't do it by yourself.
Nope.
So,
just to let you know what I've done over the years for animals. My old vet older gentleman, and he used to call me, you know, for all the cardiac problems. He'd give me hey, Evan, what do you think of this arrhythmia here? I think it's ventricular tachycardia. And we'd go over things, and, you know, he was in charge, and I would tell him, don't you charge these people a penny. And I used to get beautiful cards with the dog on it and whatever and things of that nature. That's just the way I was. I must say, I miss my old vets. Forgive me for saying that.
I also think I want to go off of what Dr. King was saying as to why the techs were getting so upset coming from myself. The word scam is very offensive. It was mm-hmm. like, oh my God, ow, because me personally and these two other women, our goal right. is to advocate for animals. I am my patient's voice. Their owners are their voice. And I think we were also upset because we are already underpaid as it is. Which, I mean, at this point, everybody is, because inflation is so intense. But I think it was also, like I said, coming from my standpoint, you're asking us to lower pricing of lab. You're asking us to not upcharge. So that's taking even more money away from us. Mm-hmm. So then that's even more
again,
like,
I'm not saying
oh my God,
not underpaid.
What do we, yeah.
You're paid less than some workers are paid in McDonald's now in California. I think it's ridiculous. But just from an outsider, and I'm telling you, a lot of outsiders think this, there are some vets out there that are doing, that are profiting. That's just
that's in every industry.
I gotcha. And I think there are lots of vet techs that are underpaid. I'm all for unionizing when there needs to be unionizing. I'm not saying you guys are not underpaid. And I apologize if you felt that was an affront on the techs. I didn't even think about the techs when I was doing that. You guys have nothing to do with the billing or anything of such. You're workers, and you work hard, and I know what you got to do. Believe me, it's not easy. It's not easy. I got it. I've tried to pill pop cats, and I've been taught, and there's no way in the world I could ever do that. It ain't happening. My old vet showed me over and over like this. I'm like, I can't do that. That's impossible.
Why do you miss your old vets?
They're retired. I don't know. I had a cozier relationship with them.
Yeah, you had a connection.
Yeah, cozier.
But were they charging the same as the vets you go to now? Or was their charging different?
Their charges were less. It was.
Why was that?
I don't know. Just it was.
Interesting.
Yeah. Could have been the time.
Yeah.
Could have been.
Yeah. I don't know how long they've been retired for, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Times are much different than they were 5 years ago. So.
Costs are going up. I guess so. Anyway, guys, this was great.
Yes. Yes. Dr. Levine.
I want to thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. We all agree that we all love our animals. And we all agree that we would, if able to, care for our animals for the least cost as possible. And we all wish that there was a solution that both pet owners and vets could live happily ever after. But unfortunately, I guess the economics in both directions are kind of creating a bit of friction here. Maybe things will get better somehow.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we thank you for your time and your willingness to share your opinions. And also, we'd like to thank all of our listeners. And don't forget, if you like this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast provider of choice. And we'll see you next time on the Veterinary Roundtable.